The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Investors celebrating the new year. Crude oil hits the best level since 2014. Jobs report, a little disappointing, but had no impact on markets. And cryptocurrency sites seeing a deluge of new accounts. All this and much more on episode number 542 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, hello and welcome. This is Andrew Horowitz, and thanks for joining me. You join me each and every week, of course, here on the Disciplined Investor Podcast, as well as Tuesday nights with my co-host, John C. Dvorak. You can actually listen live as we are discussing various topics around the area of business, investments, finance, and join in the chat. We have a chat room set up there. So if you're interested, just go to dhunplugged.com on Tuesday evenings, 9 p.m. Eastern Time, and you can see what's going on there by joining in, listening live. And of course, if you choose to, you can download that at your favorite podcasting network. Well, hopefully you enjoyed the best of 2017 show that we produced last week. It was a lot of fun putting that together, going through some of the archives to find some of the really interesting discussions that we had over the last year or so. If you haven't listened to that, of course, you can go over right now and listen to that to episode number 541. So what happened this week? Man, pretty incredible. Investors were pretty excited about the new year, weren't they? We saw the SPY, the S&P 500, up 2.46% for the week. That's a good quarter. All in 1 week. And that was beaten by the NASDAQ 100, which was up 3.95%. The Dow Jones up 2.3%. Small caps lagged a little bit, up 1.5%. But aside from that, there's an absolute global rally going on. The Nikkei was up 4%. Emerging markets up 4.25%, all in the first week, which was, by the way, a shortened holiday week. Monday, there was no trading. So pretty incredible numbers, pretty impressive overall. And of course, that next line that we see where people are starting to put on hats, we got the Dow Jones Industrial Average cracking the 25,000 mark for the first time ever. Get out the hats. Now, let's kind of talk about a few things here. We've been talking for a while about how the growth versus value discussion, where growth-related stocks, if you split the universe of stocks into growth versus value, growth where we're looking for increasing of earnings and revenues, and value where we're looking for possibly good intrinsic value companies, high quality, potentially, or at least quality companies that have balance sheets that are solid, that are maybe dividend paying, that at the same time, when we look at these stocks, they may be discounted to what fair value may be. Just because, you know, growth stocks usually hold a much higher PE ratio, value stocks lower. Oftentimes you see the healthcare and technology, biotechs in the growth side of things. You'll see utilities and financials and possibly consumer staples in the value side. Well, over the last year, I know we talked about this, but we saw that growth, I mean, trounced value, just absolutely obliterated the returns as compared to the value. So if you split the S&P in half, we saw that growth was up like 27% or so for 2017. Value was up like 10%. Still a respectable number, but there's something definitely going on there that's different. The momentum crowd is chasing technology. They're chasing healthcare. And that's what's been pushing that up, expecting that things will continue. Earnings will continue to grow substantially. And those that are in the camp of, quote, value investors really missed out on some of that incredible rally last year. Now, the question's going to be, when does that end? When do things turn around a little bit? Because as all things do, market cycle. We see that from time to time, that growth will really outpace value. We'll see that large caps possibly are really doing well and small caps are not, or foreign stocks are really doing well, domestic or not. We'll see that there is a rotation into one versus the other. What we're looking for is the start of a reversion to the mean where value will be seen as cheaper than growth, and may look to close that really wide gap that we saw in terms of performance differential from last year and a little bit before that. So this whole concept of reversion to the mean is something that it happens often. We see it time and time again. These days, what we're seeing is more of a simple sector rotation on a very rapid basis, where one sector is not moving, maybe the small caps for a few days, whereas large caps are outpacing, and then all of a sudden it turns around in a matter of days. But this circumstance that we're looking at when it comes to growth versus value, both on a large and a small and a mid-cap basis across the board, growth has really been doing very well. And again, the question is, when does that change? What will be the spark that all of a sudden says to people that are investing, you know, maybe the growth universe is a little overdone. Maybe it's time to start thinking about simply taking some of the chips off the table and rolling it back into value where maybe those are particularly undervalued, that there's a lot better valuation. They're cheaper. There's something that I can find that I can invest in without worrying about a major sell-off because their pricing is out of line. Now, I'm not suggesting, by the way, that every area is out of line, nor am I suggesting that growth is out of line. I'm not saying that they're valued to a level that's ridiculous. However, if you look at the differences in the two sectors or the two components, and you really look at what the PE and PEG ratios are, considering what the expectations are for earnings growth in the future, you have to start to think that maybe there is some opportunity in the value side of the equation. So we talk about this reversion to the mean, the reversion to the long-term averages. And if that were to play into this, we would see that one of two things are going to happen. Either growth is going to come down substantially and value may come down a bit because, again, that's riding that average a little bit better. Or we're going to see that value is really going to vault ahead and leave growth in the dust. And why does this happen? I mean, what's involved in the system that causes this? So I sat down, I wanted to list a few of these things and kind of talk to you about this. So the first thing you have is the idea that traditional asset allocators are doing rebalancing. And how that works is that they take their portfolios and they look at their overall percentage allocated to each various sector and subsector and industry or however they actually allocate capital. And they start looking at it and they say, wow, you know, we have this position in large cap growth, for example, and we wanted a 5% position, but over the last couple of years, it outperformed so greatly that maybe we're up to a 7.5% position in that right now, where our value component of the portfolio has not really kept up as well. It's still sitting, if we had a 5% allocation there, at 5% of the total portfolio value. So it may have moved up, of course. It didn't move down necessarily, but it didn't move up as much. So what happens is traditional asset allocators will rebalance to their model. They'll take some money off the top of the growth investment in this example, and they'll put it possibly into the value area of their portfolio. Now, this also happens with things like when commodities aren't doing well, or maybe real estate has a great period, whatever it may be, they take a little bit off the top, they fill up whatever the holes are to keep their model intact. The second thing is, we look at those that are focusing on fundamentals. And we look at the momentum and the cheapness of stocks. So those that are looking at fundamentals more, and those that are really fundamental analysts will start possibly to look at this as a point where there is no further value and upgrades potentially that they can squeeze out of a particular name because the stock has run well ahead of where they expect it to be over the next, let's say, 12, 18, 24 months. Momentum has really taken them for a really good ride, and they're trying to find stocks on a fundamental basis that are cheaper. And when we have a condition like we've seen recently where these growth stocks have really moved along, well, momentum players will continue to ride that wave. But those that are looking at the value side are going to start to add more money to their value names and take money off the top again of their more growth-related names. The next thing we have is the concept of risk on and risk off, which will benefit one or the other sectors. Risk on is usually associated with growth stocks, momentum stocks, day trading or swing trading, where value is usually looked at as long-term, right? We've heard so many times that, well, GE is a value stock and, you know, we're gonna invest in this for the long-term. This is a core holding of a portfolio. And meanwhile, it came down. And each time it comes down, you look at the valuation, you look at this and you say, well, it's just too cheap at this point. You keep buying into it. Now, GE is an interesting scenario because it kept on coming down, it seems, forever. Was one of the worst performing stocks out there last year. However, this year is a new year and they're starting to buy it. Now, I don't know what 1 year versus the next year has to do with anything. It could be some tax trading that's going on and selling out to take the tax loss, waiting 30 days, buying back in. But if, in fact, we do see a risk on, risk off switch right now, we have clearly been on for some time here, a risk on environment. I don't think anybody's doubting that. But if we start to see that things are lagging a bit, I would expect that the growth stocks will get hit harder than value and therefore would be a better place to hide out, more defensive. If in fact we see any corrective action, if it ever comes, into the markets. And as I mentioned before, the complexion of this market cycle that we've seen recently has a good amount of sector rotation. If one style moves out of favor for some time, it may be picked up in the next phase of the rotation. So again, that's back to that whole idea that we may see some people starting to nibble into the area of value. And finally, we have spread traders. Spread traders are going to look at one sector or style against another, one being overvalued, one being undervalued, or one looking as it possibly run its course and maybe go short that and go long the other. So there's a variety of different reasons why we may see this reversion to the mean trade start to pick up a little bit. Now, whether or not you're a believer in growth-oriented companies or value-oriented companies, you have to keep on the watch of this. Now, what we did here is in our global allocations portfolio for our clients, we've begun the process of slanting the portfolio a little bit more towards value. We took some of the positioning and gains off of the growth on a large cap basis right now, and we started to move it into a large cap value orientation that is going to be hopefully looked at as something that is going to be picked up as an idea that it's much cheaper. There's much more opportunity because they haven't participated as much. Or as I mentioned earlier, as possibly a more defensive posture if in fact we do see some kind of a sell-off in the markets. Now, again, I'm not predicting a sell-off necessarily, but if I was saying, oh, listen, we are going to see a correction so deep, blah, 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 and we're going to see that the market's going to sell off in the next 6 months, well, then I would take a lot more chips off the table and maybe reallocate them to something that's not affected by the market, whether it's cash, whether it's some particular short-term bonds, whether it's alternative investments. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is we're keeping our general allocation towards that sector of equities, but we're slanting them towards value. So that can be seen as a defensive move or not as an aggressive move. But again, it's not a move that's predicting any kind of major market setback that would happen because of anything that is actually out there right now. We're not seeing that the economy is slowing down necessarily. We're not seeing that there's anything going on that the Fed's going to do that's going to raise rates, you know, dramatically, which we'll talk about a little bit later. We're not seeing anything necessarily on the global level, aside from a few things out there in, you know, Middle East and North Korea and some issues with Mexico and Latin America, but we're not really seeing any of those right now at this exact moment. But still, it makes sense sometimes to look at your allocation, see where you have too much allocated that has run up for such a long time, where valuations may be a little bit stretched, and look for the other opportunities while staying in an equity allocation. And I'm just talking about the equity allocation now. I'm not talking about the commodities, the real estate, the cash. You know, I'm not talking about anything else but other than equities and really focusing on large cap for the moment. So think about the idea of reversion to the mean and cycles and how market participants operate and how they look to getting cheapness and where they're going to find that and how in effect you could rebalance a portfolio to be more in line with where you are in terms of the outlook, midterm and long-term. So something to think about. I mentioned the economy. And we had a few economic reports that were released last week. And there was an interesting jobs report. Remember, during the middle of the week, we saw that ADP came out with a report that showed there was 250,000 new jobs added to the payrolls on the private side. That was pretty good. A blowout number, in fact. Pretty exciting that we're seeing upwards of 2 million jobs added to the payrolls over the last year. So, of course, when we look at that number, we have to think that, well, it's probably going to be a pretty good number on Friday that we saw. And there was a lot of optimism going into that number that we would see a blowout number there as well. However, it didn't seem to play out that way. In fact, we saw there was a print of 148,000 of new hires added to the payroll in the month of December. Expectations were like 195,000. That was kind of disappointing. The unemployment rate stuck at 4.1%. Markets sold off. When I say sold off, pre-market when this came out, markets may have been up. The S&P 500 E-minis were up, I don't know, about maybe seven points. Came down to about plus five. Turned around, moved up to about plus nine, plus 10. And then by the time the market opened, they were still about plus eight or nine or so. And then it was off to the races. Like, who cares? Maybe they think it's a one-time phenomena. But what I did was I wanted to take a look at what have the numbers been? Where are we? And separating the noisy monthly numbers, separating the numbers on a one-month basis and just kind of checking those off and saying, okay, we hit 200, 180, 140, whatever the numbers are. I put on a very simple six-month moving average, and I was surprised to see that if we look back some time over the last 2 years, that we're actually seeing a slope of the six-month moving average going significantly from top left to bottom right. Now, I mean, it's not straight down, but I would say it's about a 40-degree angle, 35 maybe. But there's definitely a slope to the downside. So while we've seen some decent numbers, the six-month average, which smooths out our overall report information over a period of time, has actually been slowing. And maybe that's something that the Fed is seeing. Maybe this is why they're so stubborn. We're talking about there's still a lot of labor slack out there. Or maybe what the reality here is that we're at full employment and it's really tough to add a lot more to the payrolls when we have technology out there that is really providing an incredible amount of efficiency and a much lower requirement for individuals to do certain jobs. And being at full employment, it creates a pretty significant hurdle to keep on adding major amounts of employees to the payrolls. So again, we're at 4.1% of an unemployment rate. We picked up about 145,000 new. That's all good. And we could probably talk about how there's a certain amount that has to be of new hires that have to keep on coming in to keep the numbers solid. But still, we're not seeing a negative number at this point. And the one number that we saw negative recently was really due to all the flooding and weather issues that was very easily explained. I think we all accepted that. So again, we saw this. If you haven't seen it, I did provide that chart and I tweeted it out on Friday. So if you haven't followed my Twitter stream, which is the handle of Andrew Horowitz, one word, you can find that on there. We also saw the ISM manufacturing survey. It came in a little hot. This is the part of the economy that deals with things like construction and manufacturing and factories and warehouses and the area that is much, much less of importance today than it was, let's call it 30 years ago, 40 years ago, 50 years ago. You probably heard me talk about this before, but our economy is about 70% services these days, 30% manufacturing. So the manufacturing numbers, though, have been really strong, not only here, by the way, around the entire world. It's pretty interesting to see that some areas like Europe are just cranking out numbers in terms of their manufacturing. They call them the PMIs, Purchasing Managers Index. And they are very strong, showing that there is a tremendous amount of growth that has been going on in the world overall. I mean, from Asia to Latin America to Europe to the emerging markets, really seeing some very impressive numbers when it comes to PMIs. Now, the services index was a little bit disappointing, but again, this is a one-month situation. It's been coming down a little bit, but we were at record highs. We were, close to just really strong numbers from the services area, came back a little bit. Now, next week, there's some important things coming out as well, because we know that one of the things that has been watched very carefully by central banks is inflation, almost too carefully, in my opinion. And we've seen that, for whatever reason, the phenomena where inflation just is stubbornly low will not seem to pick up beyond the level that is a concern by the Fed, thereby keeping rates very low, has been something that has been strange. It's very unexplainable. Even the Fed is having difficulty explaining this. So we're going to be seeing PPI, which is the producer price index, wholesale goods, if you will, and CPI coming out, as well as retail sales this week. The hope is that, and this is kind of a crazy thing to say, but the hope is that we're going to see some pickup in both CPI and PPI and retail sales. One of the reasons is that we have sentiment and optimism pretty high. Markets at an all-time high. A lot of discussion about bonuses being given out by many companies on a one-time basis, as well as a hike in wages due to the tax reform and how much additional monies that will be saved by companies. We're seeing a lot of announcements, $1,000 per person, minimum hike of wages up to $15 per hour at a minimum. So expectations are for PPI to come in at 0.2% on a month over month basis, CPI at 0.3%. Now, annualized, that will continue to show that, yes, inflation is picking up. Plus, we're going to see that, I think, energy with crude oil capping its best level since 2014 is going to also add to some of the pressure on inflation. Now, I expect that if we saw a hot number, the Fed's reaction would be, oh, it is temporary. A lot of it has to do with energy. Blah, 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 blah. Remember something. The Fed is all about protecting their book and making sure that people understand that for a very long time, they're going to keep interest rates very low. So what's really amazing, though, is that with all that's going on, with corporate profits being at record, with a new tax plan that's going to increase potentially the profitability of companies, with inflation very close to the number that would be a demarcation point, with employment essentially at full employment, that the Fed is still very uncomfortable changing from a very slow, or I guess a glacial pace of rate hikes back to normalization. The big question is going to be that even with the Fed normalizing by a small amount, 25 basis points over a couple, three times next year, what does that mean for the economy? How much money is going to be drained from the system by increasing rates and slowing down their quantitative easing program? And how is that really going to impact and affect the benefits, and maybe even offset some of the benefits, from the tax reform bill? Answers that I don't really have a handle on just yet. But the good news is that next week, our guest does have a good insight into this. It's going to be Danielle DiMartino Booth. We've had her on before. You've probably seen her. She's been on a lot of television and being interviewed quite often recently. But I know that these are things that I'm going to ask her about, and I want to find out, because there is an offsetting amount of benefit that's going to go on here. We got to see really how much of that is going to play into this market and what that's going to mean. So far, we do also know very clearly that it doesn't matter to the markets. We know that for the most part, there is no concern about the economy, because we saw a disappointing jobs number and nothing happened. We see the Fed raising rates and talking about how things are better. Not much is happening. We saw that rates have gone up for some time and bond yields are still very depressed, budging only slightly, and the yield curve continuing to flatten, while at the same time, which it should not be good for banks and financial companies doing really well. So none of this seems to matter. Now, one day it will. But so far, and perhaps because of the excitement of the potential for a 21% tax rate for corporations, nobody cares. Maybe because it's a bit of euphoria and high sentiment with investors. They just don't care. Maybe because liquidity is still there from not only our central bank, but more so from other central banks around the world at record levels, that it doesn't matter. But you and I both know something. Down deep, we know something. It's going to matter one day. So now is the time to ride out some of the benefits of what we know is going on here, but be prepared for the what if. Now, don't be shaken out until it happens. Be careful not to get ahead of yourself. Don't try to get too far ahead of these markets, because I tell you something, if you do, we've seen time and time again stories of people who got ahead of this. I'm pulling all my money out because this guy's getting elected, or I'm pulling all my money out because of South and North Korea. I'm pulling all my money out because oil prices are doing. And what happened? Didn't seem to work out so well in the last few years. You got to adjust your whole your mindset and your outlook to what's the reality of what's going on. And one of the things that we know is going on right now is that, again, sentiment is very high and people are not really caring about all the little things that come around it, all the issues maybe that are political and geopolitical concerns. They're not concerned about maybe a dip in the economy right now. They believe that there is just no justification to take money out of stocks, and because we haven't seen any corrections. There's no fear. We see the VIX right at about 9. Low numbers. So make sure to tune in next week when Danielle DiMartino Booth is our guest, and we can ask a lot of these questions, get some real good clarification. What I thought we'd do now is spend a little time on a few listener questions that came in. We got a good chunk of listener questions, and I answered a good amount of them through emails. If you want to ask me a question that could end up on an upcoming show, what I'd like you to do is go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Don't be scared. Don't worry. It's okay. No question is too stupid or too smart, too easy or too hard. And if it is, I'll tell you. But don't be embarrassed or worried about any of that. I want you to make sure to get what you need from what we're doing here, okay? The whole point here is for some education and some insight. So use that. Go over to the Disciplined Investor, and on the top, there's an Ask Andrew button. Click that and ask me a question. And by the way, I've asked you for this, and I haven't seen a lot of reviews come in. I'd like you to do me a favor. If you go over to the site right now, thedisciplinedinvestor.com, under the on the menu there, on the top, where it says podcast, you drop it down, it says podcast review, submit a podcast review. Do me a favor. Spend a couple of minutes. Tell me what you think of the show. Be honest. And we'll get that up on the site as well. I really need to get some of your insight into what we've been doing, how we've been doing it, how it affects you. You know, whatever you want to write, if it's just a sentence or a couple of sentences, just put it in there. I really would like to have your insight and your comments on what's going on. So two things. First is ask Andrew. You can ask questions. And the second thing is a podcast review or show review. All right, so I got a few questions I wanted to answer. Then we're going to get to some discussion about crypto and earnings season. So the first one's from Nick. He says, hi, Andrew. Although I'm not an investor in any shape or form, I've been listening to TDI and DH Unplugged for years. Thanks for all the information and education. You're welcome. I'm writing this on Thursday, January 4th, after all the news about the flaws in the current chips and why is Intel only getting somewhat punished by the market? I would assume that all big companies, I'm having trouble reading this. Let's see. I would assume that all big companies will wait for a next generation of chips to update hardware. It seems that all cell phones are affected too. Apple just came out with the statement, and Google is also discovering bugs. Why would I buy an $800 phone that I know has a hardware flaw and its CPU? Maybe I'm exaggerating, but why is the NASDAQ not down 10% this day? Actually finished positive on the day. As I said, a question from an average Joe. It's a good question. It's a good question. It's a big question. It's a bigger issue. So I talked about this a moment ago, right? I said, well, we have really good sentiment, and a lot of the information that we're seeing here and there that may be considered negative is not really affecting markets. It doesn't have any significant impact. The Intel issue, I think what's happening here is that Intel has come out and said that they don't believe there's going to be any economic damage done by this. That's what they said. And it's going to be probably a software fix by most of the manufacturers. And I'll tell you something else. A lot of people don't know. They don't care. They figure there's got to be flaws here and there and security issues here and there. And I'm not too worried. I don't think they've probably been hacked before. And maybe they make the wrong assumption that, Apple's got this covered, or Samsung's got this covered, or my Mac's got this covered, or, you know, Windows 10 has got this all covered. When in fact, maybe they do, maybe they don't. But this is a big issue that, by the way, is not new. I think it's going back years and years and years that this same flaw has actually been there. So with that, there is a question about, well, maybe people are going to switch to AMD or, you know, but then they think, well, maybe AMD has some of these flaws too. And they're not really too concerned because how many of the alternatives are really there? I mean, if you want the iPhone, you got to buy the iPhone. If you want a Mac, you got to buy a Mac. So what will really be interesting to see is how some companies could, in fact, benefit from this. Now, this goes way, smacks you right in the face, Nick, right? Who's benefiting? Well, if you think about it for a second, there's probably a good amount of companies that are going to provide this fix, which may, in fact, actually slow down the processing speed of the chip. Therefore, if those chips are in a lot of rack servers and running in the cloud, then there is the potential that some people that are buying the bandwidth and processing power of these chips in the cloud right now will have to get additional processing power and pay to do so. So there is the potential for some companies to pass through charges to speed up the process if, in fact, they have to create a patch for this and it does slow down the chip and processing speed. Possibly. I don't necessarily see this as some. I mean, Intel was down on this news. Didn't go down that far. Not many choices. Where else are you going to go? Qualcomm? Maybe, no. They don't really have this. So where is the real problem here? If it's going to be fixed and if there's no retroactive financial damage that's been done that can be directly tied to this that will be brought back in a suit against Intel, I don't think anybody cares. Which then goes right back to what we talked about earlier about the economic data and how the markets are perceiving risk. Hopefully that answers that. Now, Jim writes, he says, Andrew, I'm a banker with a client who is an algo trader. Trades millions of shares every day. In some cases, he says, he holds stocks only seconds to make small amounts per share on many trades. I know he makes millions in profits every year. It's just one guy. If there are many other guys that like this guy, it seems that it could be a big problem for the market someday. He is out of the market every night, so maybe not. Maybe you could discuss this sometime on your podcast. I think, Jim, we've talked about the whole idea of high-frequency traders as well as the idea that you have algo traders that are playing with markets. We see this. I mean, right off the open of the market. You think everybody's just attacking the market on the open? Either direction. You see, when markets come down pretty hard, right, in a 5 or 10 or 30-minute period, how they're just picked right back up or vice versa. You have machines that are trading, looking to make scalps on indices, individual stocks. And this is the state of what we live in right now. It wasn't like this 20 years ago. But then again, there was market makers 20 years ago. They're out of business. The entire business model of a market maker is gone. The floor of the New York Stock Exchange is basically done. There are really no major exchanges with people that are doing the old, you know, with the tickets and throwing them up in the air and kind of shouting and yelling. It's all electronic. Where's the problem? The problem could be, I guess, if you do have a synchronized sell-off that all of the switches go negative. That could be. Right now, the switches are all, hey, buy, 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 buy. If something changes with the switches, I would venture that there's a lot less liquidity in the markets today than there was last year, than there was the year before that, than there was 5 years before that. Part of that is due to the fact that companies have been merging. So there's less shares in the market. Yeah, some IPOs out there, of course. A lot of companies have been buying back shares. A lot of shares off the market. Therefore, liquidity's less. So the problem could be possibly if these things are set to the sell mode. But again, if you can be nimble enough to go short, you can profit as well. I don't know where this goes awry unless the machines go cuckoo, which is possible. We've seen fat finger trades that are clearly something that goes on. We've seen flash crashes that go on and things like that. I mean, there's definitely a possibility that something goes wrong here. But with this situation where he's in and out, really what this amounts to, as we've talked about so many times, not recently though, is it's a tax. Investors have to pay a tax. And who do you pay the tax to when you're trading? To scalpers, to the high-frequency traders, to the algo traders. Whereas they can sniff out where your trading is and try to move markets against you a little bit in order to make you bid up or bid down. And it's a tax, essentially a tax on my trading. I have to pay more to do so because I have these traders that are skimming a little bit, maybe, you know, a quarter of a cent every trade, or, you know, even smaller than that, even just little bitty bits that they're trying to get in between and make me essentially change my bid and chase a particular level because it's moving up or I perceive it as moving up and I'm going to, you know, buy it at a higher price. If you ever looked at a level two when you're trading and even a pretty actively traded stock, if you have a reasonable amount of size that you put on a trade, Sometimes what happens is you can move the market. You'll move that ask up. So let's say the bid is, you know, 10 by 1005, just as a number, and you push it to 1003, and all of a sudden that 05 disappears, and now it's 07. How is that happening so quickly? Or if you've ever seen the 1003 that you put up there, all of a sudden three other players switch to 1003 as well. Well, that's not just necessarily individuals doing that. That's machines doing a copy of the bid. And you don't know, by the way, if that machine is the guy on the other side too. The guy that said 07. He tries to push it up, getting other people to buy in of shares that he has at a lower price that he's trying to sell, therefore selling into you at the same time, but making it look like there's a lot more buyers. I know that's kind of crazy, but that's what goes on. All right, last question here. I think it's the last one. Let's see. Yep, that's the last one. Jenny writes in, he says, I keep seeing many discussions that the RSI is an indicator that seems to be very overbought these days, but markets never seem to come down. Should I keep paying attention to these discussions? That's a good question. So the RSI is an indicator that seems to be the relative strength indicator. It seems to be something that is looked at by a lot of traders that don't necessarily follow technicals. I find that the people that I'm watching talk about this are really fundamentalists, and they look at this RSI. It's just one of these indicators like the MACD or stochastics that can go to overbought or oversold, and you look at certain numbers and, you know, plus 70 or minus below this level or above this level, depending on how you program your indicator. And yes, a lot of them have been in overbought territory. One of the things we do know is that stocks can maintain overbought or somewhat overvalued for a much longer time than you probably anticipate. On the opposite side of that, when you see stocks drop dramatically, oftentimes, especially if it's a quick drop, they don't stay oversold for as long of a period because you have a lot of people that have optimism and want to buy it and find it to be a cheap position. A lot of people don't want to sell their positions when they're at their peaks or when they're starting to, you know, break out or move up. So the RSI on the upward side, when it's overbought, particularly on a high level, doesn't really seem to have as much punch, especially when you have a backdrop of a market that doesn't seem to have any sell-off capacity. So what happens is that the RSI, I think, is a little bit less meaningful. Not that it's not meaningful, but less meaningful when we see that general conditions are good. What I'd prefer to find is an RSI that's really negative in a market that's really negative and starting to turn higher. Those are positions that I'd like to grab onto or look at least. I mean, I look at a variety of things like market profile and volume at price, and I prefer those. But RSI, MACD, stochastics, and these oscillators, and I mean, these are important to look at, but I think that you have to put it into perspective and understand what you're looking at in the context of a much bigger market positioning. If that makes sense, Jenny. So as I mentioned, just go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com and simply go to the Ask Andrew section on the top there, on the button on top, and ask a question, and we'll do our best to get it on the air in an upcoming show. Why don't we take a minute and talk about crypto? Everybody else is these days. So might as well spend a little time talking about what's going on here. I can't even begin to tell you the interest that I am hearing from, I mean, people of all walks of life, from all areas of experience when it comes to stocks and markets and investing. People that really haven't even ever been involved in discussing anything to do with money or finance are just going crazy for this whole idea of Bitcoin and cryptos and Ethereum and just the whole range. People, I mean, it's getting pretty intense. As a matter of fact, I'll tell you, it's getting so outrageous. And I don't mean that in a negative way necessarily, but the buzz and some of the interest has gotten so incredible that we're seeing that some exchanges have been overwhelmed with new account signups, and they decided to actually close their doors to new users. So these are the exchanges like, you know, you probably heard of Coinbase, Bittrex, this Kraken, this Poloniex, I think how you pronounce that one, Bitfinex, there's this one called Binance, closing its door. They announced that, I think it was on Friday, they announced that they're not taking on any new accounts until they finish an upgrade of their service. Now, a lot of this incredible amount of accounts that are being opened, and we're talking about a lot, have been some based on some of the interest in the other coins. We'll call them altcoins, right? Not necessarily your Bitcoin, your Ethereum, your Litecoin, Bitcoin Cash. We're talking about things like Ripple. We're looking at things like Monero. We're looking at the coins that are the next tier. Not that they're worse or better than the other, just kind of one step away from the base. And also we're seeing that because of the crackdowns that we have seen in areas like South Korea, Japan, China, there is a massive move to open accounts outside anywhere they can so they could trade these currencies or these coins. Sites have been really slow. We track these. We look at, you know, what's going on. I have some accounts that I've opened up over time in various different exchanges for different reasons. And I got to tell you, they're getting really slow. Sometimes some of them don't even open up. Can't even log in. So what does this mean? Well, potentially this big interest that we're seeing not only in places like Coinbase or Bitcom.com or any of the core sites that have mainly Bitcoin and the names that you probably know, it's possible that there's now a great interest in the much less expensive, although I'm not talking about valuation, I'm talking about less expensive altcoins, and therefore may keep a bid under this market for some time. Where everybody was predicting a crash, I mean, yes, we saw that Bitcoin came down from, you know, 19 and change down to 12.5. It's right back up to 16 or 17,000 right now. Ethereum is an all-time high. Seeing that Litecoin, even though the founder and the creator sold all of his Litecoins, according to him, dropped down a little bit, but still sticking really close to its all-time high. So to think about how much interest is actually in the market, what I did was I went over to coinmarketcap.com and wanted to take a look at what's going on with all these coins. How many coins are there? What's the valuation of all the coins out there? How much interest, how much money is really being pushed into this? So right now, amazingly, if you didn't know, there's not just 5 or 6 or 10 or 20 or 100 coins. Right now, the coin market cap is showing a total of 1,380 coins that are now trading. 1,380 coins. That's pretty remarkable. Some have a lot less volume and are much smaller right now, but they're still trading 1,380. The total market cap, if you take the dollar value of all of the coins that are currently out there, is $830 billion. And that's only looking at about 1,000 of the coins that show market cap valuations. In terms of valuation of those coins that are over a billion, 43 coins now. The top coins, the top three, you know what those are? Well, number one is Bitcoin. Number two, in terms of market cap, it was Ethereum for a long time. Now it's Ripple. Probably saying, what the hell is Ripple? Well, it's another coin. Now, you can't buy them on Coinbase, Ripple, at this point, but there is some talk about Ripple being moved over to Coinbase. And when you do see that, you usually see, we've seen this twice now, a major move in the price. Ripple is trading at about $2.75 per coin, $2.75. And Ethereum is number three. But there's still a lot of problems here. So let me just take you through something. You may have been following me on Twitter when I talked about this, but I want to see how long it would take to transfer Ethereum from one platform to another, just to understand this. I've done this with Bitcoin before. I've done it with Bitcoin Cash. I've done it with Litecoin. But I want to check out Ethereum. Ethereum was moving up a lot. A lot of people talking about how this is the next thing that's really going to be big. It's the only coin that really matters. So I took coins from my GDAX or Coinbase account, but it's a separate platform that's owned by Coinbase. It's just cheaper to trade with them. I moved it to another exchange. Took over 8 hours to arrive. Now, I don't think that was really necessarily a blockchain confirmation process issue, where once the coin goes, it has to go through a variety of confirmations until it arrives, checks and balances, if you will, until it arrives at the other platform in order to get confirmed and to be in completed status with the other platform, with the other exchange. I really think in this circumstance, it was due to the backlog at the Coinbase or GDAX exchange. Nevertheless, 8 hours. 8 hours. I did the same thing where I took some Litecoin. I went back the other way. I went Litecoin to GDAX. So I went from one exchange. It took 15 minutes to be confirmed. Done. So I did some research on this, and a lot of people have the same experience. You know, really long times to get your money around. So, I mean, think about that. It's one thing if you decide you want to do an ACH transfer to your bank and arrive somewhere the next day. You know it's going to be $100. It's going to arrive. It's going to be $100. It's another thing if you transfer one coin that currently is valued at $500, let's say, and it takes 8 hours to get there. And with the kind of trading that's going on, it could be worth $500. It could be worth $450. It could be worth $300 or $800. Who knows? So if this is being used as a currency, I don't think so. Now, Ripple is said to be almost instantaneous. That's why it's gained such popularity. But again, it's not traded on some of the major exchanges. So I have a real problem with understanding how people are saying this is a currency. It's really a trading mechanism. It's a speculative investment at this point for those particularly that take such a long time to transfer from place to place. So this is just a quick update on scratching the surface on this whole thing. There's a lot of just a tremendous amount of interest on this. But I really encourage you to, first of all, realize that this is very complex. This whole crypto and currency, the ICO markets and how you have to get in if you want an ICO, very complex, you have to have some technical abilities. Get yourself educated. At least go and look. Don't just go on YouTube. Don't do that. Go and find some good sources. Look at all the sites. Read some white papers on the ICOs that are coming out soon. And understand what's happening with this, how this whole thing works. I'll tell you that if you do want to follow some of these, there's a couple of easy ways to do so. One is, and I'll give you this, if you want to look at some good charts, you want to understand what's going on, you want to be able to track things, you can look at tradingview.com. I gave this to a couple of people and they wrote me thank you notes recently. Tradingview.com, a really good place to store a watch list of the cryptos. They have an incredible list of cryptos that are available to kind of watch. You could just get the free version of this and check it out. If you want to buy it, there's some other things that it does. But tradingview.com has some really cool stuff there. Now, one thing for what it's worth, it does seem that there's a growing backdrop of discussions that are coming out about regulation, especially as we reach the $1 trillion market cap level for coins right now. And it's only going to grow further, if not from the price appreciation, but the ICOs that are coming to the market. Seems to be, a couple all the time, it seems. But we'll have to watch for that because, again, South Korea is talking about it. Some other countries are talking about some of this. So far, most have been like, this piece of crap. It's nothing. It's speculation. Well, if it's such shit, if it's such crap, if it's nothing but a scam, as they've talked about, a Ponzi scheme, how come the regulators aren't cracking down more, protecting us from all this? A lot of talk and trying to talk this thing down, but not a lot of impact on that market. And we are seeing some bad players out there, of course, that are involved in this. So just be very careful when you're in this space doing anything. Finally, just want to talk very briefly. We do have earnings season coming up. Plenty of analysis that we've seen and analyst upgrades of late. As a matter of fact, I was looking at the list of upgrades and downgrades over the last week, and it's pretty even number of upgrade and downgrades. It did seem like there was a few more upgrades. One of the things that I noticed, though, was that the upgrades seem to be on the more well-known names out there, and the downgrades were names, yeah, you may not have heard of. Now, next week, especially Friday, is when the earnings season is really going to start to flow. What we're going to be looking for? Well, we know the banks and financials are going to be taking some significant one-time hits due to the tax reform. There's some deferred tax accounts that they have that they're going to bring back. And because tax are lower, they're going to be taking, you know, I don't know, anywhere from a few hundred million to billions of dollars of one-time write-down hits. That's probably going to be overlooked by markets because of one-time. Markets like to overlook a one-time situation. But we're going to see Friday, JP Morgan and Wells Fargo come out. Now, after this week, we're going to start to see heavier stream of earnings into next week. And then about 2 weeks from now, probably the biggest, you know, stream. We'll see how, and what we need to be looking for is not only looking and understanding what is going on with their current earnings, but what is management saying about the benefits that they see for their companies and the bottom line with a reduced tax rate and the new tax code and what they're seeing on a global basis in terms of opportunities. So that's really going to be the read-through. What we need to be paying attention to is the guidance and what they believe is going to be the opportunities based on what they see as and what we've heard is a major tax savings for these companies. So that's going to be the big ticket right there. If you want to check out what we have to offer, of course, Investology is open and ready for you to start crafting your own personal portfolio, Investology with an E. You can find out all the strategies, all the information that we have to offer. And I encourage you to do so over on the Disciplined Investor. Just scroll down the front page. You'll see everything that's there. There's some videos of tutorials on the walking through the various processes and what it is that we do with the various strategies like the global allocations and Investology, as well as the TDI managed growth strategy. Check it out. I think you'll really enjoy it. And maybe time to start thinking about some of this. Until next week, I bid you adieu.
The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.